calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. The United Nations, established in 1945 after World War II, the UN has negotiated 172 peaceful settlements in its existence, including helping bring about the end to the Iran-Iraq War that killed over a million people, the civil war in El Salvador, the withdrawal of Soviet troops from Afghanistan. In peacekeeping, UN peace operations have helped uphold ceasefires, conduct free and fair elections, monitor troop withdrawals, deter violence, create free countries, and aid political stability in El Salvador, Cambodia, Macedonia, Mozambique, Namibia, Cyprus, Haiti, to name a few. The International Atomic Energy Agency of the UN has helped minimize the spread of nuclear weapons by inspecting and monitoring nuclear reactors and facilities in 90 countries. The UN has also advanced armed control through international agreements such as the Chemical Weapons Convention and the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. The United Nations World Health Organization succeeded in eradicating smallpox in 1980 after a 13-year effort, wiped out polio from the Western Hemisphere. In 1974, only 5% of children in developing countries were immunized against polio, tetanus, measles, whooping cough, diphtheria, and TB. By 1995, however, that's, 21 years later, as a result of the efforts of the United Nations Children's Fund, there was an 80% immunization rate, saving the lives of over 3 million children. In alleviating chronic hunger and rural poverty, the UN has provided famine relief to millions of people. The International Fund for Agricultural Development developed a system that is benefiting over 230 million people in nearly 100 developing countries and building long-term hunger relief. In 1997 alone, 22 million refugees, mostly women and children, received food, shelter, medical aid, education, and repatriation assistance from the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. The UN is leading the effort to make an international treaty that would limit deforestation, promote sustainable forestry practices in 90 countries, has provided helped provide safe drinking water for 1.3 billion people in rural areas, and UN programs to promote education and advancement for women have helped raise their literacy rate in developing countries from 36% in 1970 to 56% in 1990. In the face of this, Thomas Kilgallon is with us, K-I-L-G-A-N-N-O-N, his website, thomaskilgallon.com. New book with a foreword by Oliver North, Diplomatic Divorce, Why America Should End Its Love Affair with the United Nations. Thomas Kilgallon, welcome to the program.
Tom, it's great to be with you. How are you today?
I'm just great, but I'll get better. Listen, I just laid out the case for the United Nations. Or actually, it's not even the case for the United Nations. It's some of the stuff that they have done. I would say the case for the United Nations is that you need to talk to bad people. You need to talk to your enemies. It's one of the ways that you resolve conflict and hopefully maintain peace in the world. You think that we should just walk away from the United Nations, or for that matter, just bring the whole thing down.
Well, it was quite a laundry list that you read off there. I'm surprised the UN didn't also claim to invent strawberry ice cream, too. It was,
But these are all real accomplishments, Thomas.
Well, that's what they'd like us to believe.
Which one would you dispute?
I think the time has come for America to leave the United Nations. That is correct. I think it is an anti-American, anti-Semitic, corrupt institution, which is not in the best interest of American foreign policy, and I don't think that we ought to be a member any longer.
How would standing alone in the world and thumbing our nose at a world body like this help American foreign policy?
Well, my contention, Tom, is that I don't want to see the United States withdraw from the world. Quite the contrary. I do think that we ought to be engaged in the world. I think as the lone superpower, we ought to be talking to every country around the world. We ought to have trade. We ought to have economic and cultural and student exchanges with as many countries as possible. What I'm arguing in Diplomatic Divorce is that we should not have our foreign policy chaperoned by the United Nations. I think it undermines our foreign policy, and I think it injures our national pride, as we will see next week when the President of the United States, who holds the greatest political office in the world, will be forced to share the stage with the Iranian dictator who is called for the destruction of another member state of the UN.
Last I looked, that Iranian dictator was elected by a democratic majority.
Well, that doesn't, he is still an individual who is who has called for the destruction of Israel, a member state of the United Nations.
Now, we may not like what he says, but he was elected by a Democratic majority.
And he is somebody who is trying to acquire nuclear weapons in spite of the world community being opposed to him.
Yeah, and Pakistan has nuclear weapons. And there we've got a leader who was installed himself in a military coup and rules as a dictator. But I'm assuming you don't have any problem with him.
Well, you're right. It's a dangerous world, and that's why I think that America really ought to be steering its own ship and not allowing the United Nations to dictate what our foreign policy is or influence our foreign policy in ways that are contrary to America's interests. There's no
question
that
the world is
dangerous. But
the United Nations doesn't dictate our foreign policy. The United Nations is a forum. Correct me if I'm wrong. My understanding is essentially the only thing that the United Nations prevents us from doing in terms of foreign policy overtly that we could have done or that we could do if we were not a member of the United Nations is launch a preemptive war against another country.
And they tried to do that with Iraq. And I think, you know, if you want to go down and say technically this and technically that, sure, the United Nations is not going to prevent us. The real problem.
Well, how else does the United Nations? You said they're chaperoning our foreign policy. The UN specifically says it is an international crime to launch a preemptive war. It will still be an international crime even if we leave the United Nations, but at least we won't be bound by the treaties. But what else is there? In what other way do they affect our foreign policy?
Sure. Look at what has happened over about the last month. When Hezbollah was attacking Israel, and Israel tried to disarm and disband a terrorist organization as called for by a UN resolution, what the United Nations did was foment a lot of anxiety and hatred against Israel, and basically
the United Nations didn't do that, Thomas. There were individual members of the United Nations who were doing that.
Well,
the UN as a body was not speaking like that.
But sure it was. Kofi Annan was doing it. He was saying that Israel was using excessive force. He was using his fluence and his microphone as Secretary General to do exactly that.
He was speaking for himself. He was quite clear about that. He was not speaking on behalf of the United Nations.
Well, let's be clear. When George Bush doesn't speak for himself. George Bush is always the President of the United States.
No, there are actually times when George Bush speaks for himself.
No, Kofi Annan is always the Secretary General. You can't say, well, I'm not, you know, this is my personal
opinion. George Bush has said, for example, that, you know, speaking for himself. Speaking for himself, he thinks that abortion should be illegal and women should be put in prison to get abortions. But that's not the law, and so he can't enforce that law. I mean, there have been a number of times Bush has said, speaking for myself.
You know as well as I do that when you hold an office like the presidency of the United States or the secretary generalship of the United Nations, your words carry weight. And it's as simple as that. When the Security Council told Iran that they had to stop enriching uranium, the Security Council was united, and after that, Kofi Annan went over to Iran and essentially split the Security Council. He turned his back on them and their own resolution and gave the Iranians a way to get out of that resolution.
Well, the Security Council is a democratic institution. They can fire Kofi Annan and replace him if they don't like that.
I wish they would. They
well, you know, then why not be participating with the UN? Why not be lobbying to change the direction of the course of the UN rather than saying, we don't like the way the game is playing, so we're going to take our marbles and go home? That just seems juvenile to me.
Well, I think that that too many people in the United States, and I think this is largely in the Democratic Party, but there are some in the Republican Party who believe this way too, that we ought to be listening to the United Nations, that we ought to be putting our faith and trust in them. It goes to what John Kerry said was his global test, that if the United Nations doesn't sign off on it, then we ought not to be doing it.
Yeah, the global test was the global smell test. You know, does this? Let's not refight the 2004 campaign. We're talking with Thomas Kilgannon, his book Diplomatic Divorce: Why America Should End Its Love Affair with the United Nations. Thomas, we have just 45 seconds left. I still don't get it. Why? I mean, if you can give me a good succinct reason why we should pull out of the UN, how is that going to make the world more peaceful?
We don't need it. It is injuring our national pride. It is undermining our sovereignty, and it is hurting our foreign policy.
Doesn't being a member of the World Trade Organization diminish our national sovereignty?
Absolutely. You and I are in complete agreement on that. I think the Congress has outsourced its constitutional responsibility to the World Trade Organization. I think it's an abysmal institution, and we ought to get out of it.
Hmm.
Interesting. But the purpose of the World Trade Organization, of course, is to enrich multinational corporations. The purpose of the UN is to maintain world peace.
But the UN is not maintaining world peace. It's not standing up for human rights, the two pillars on which it was built and founded. It has been an abject failure.
Then let's lobby it to reform it. Let's try to improve it.
Reform is, with all due respect, reform is a fool's errand. It's not going to happen. You know it as well as I do, Tom. It is time to diplomatically divorce ourselves from the United Nations.
I respectfully disagree. I believe in democratic institutions. I think the UN is one, but an interesting case. ThomasKilgannon.com, the website. The book, Diplomatic Divorce, Why America Should End Its Love Affair with the UN, forward by Oliver North. Thomas, thanks for being with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. Tom Hartman here with you with listener-supported radio. I'm drinking a cup of Café Femenino from Peru. Certified organic and fair trade Peruvian French roast. Right this very minute. This stuff is good. I got to tell you. From Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time, 1-800-425-2532, sponsoring this program. Please support our sponsors and support the program. And Small Dog Electronics, get your latest iPod now, 1-800-511-MAX, and smalldog.com, sacredgroundscoffee.com. 22 minutes past the hour. New poll, Americans view John Bolton as the symbol of foreign policy failures. The New York Sun reported that a new poll commissioned by the conservative Hudson Institute finds a majority of Americans believe if the United Nations is no longer effective and it cannot be reformed, it should be scrapped altogether. However, this report in the New York Sun is based on a survey that was done by Frank Luntz, who says, now this shows Americans are one scandal away from washing their hands of the United Nations. Yeah. Well, 2 weeks ago, a Melman Group poll on the United Nations was done, not Frank Luntz, an unbiased group. And what they found was a little different. 60% of Americans think it's better to work through the United Nations to share burdens and risks, compared to 31% who believe it's better to act decisively and alone. This, by the way, posted by Amanda over at thinkprogress.org. 49% believe President Bush's foreign policy has made the United States weaker, compared with just 28% who believe it's made us stronger. 52% believe Bush's foreign policy has made relations with our allies weaker, compared with just 23% who believe it's made them stronger. 61% believe that over the past few years, other countries' images of the United States have become more negative, compared with just 15% who believe it's become more positive. And 55%, again, more than half in virtually all these cases, believe it's time to change the course of Bush's foreign policy, compared with 39% who want to just stay the course. So why is Frank Luntz doing this wacky poll, and why is he out there saying, well, Americans want to scrap the UN? Well, because John Bolton is trying to get confirmed in the Senate, you see. John Bolton, who says, well, if they blow away a bunch of floors from the top of the United Nations, it won't be any problem. I wonder where his office is in the UN. Now, it's interesting to think about that, and where am I standing? By the way, one of our listeners sent me a note. Terrence says, Tom, didn't America's withdrawal from the League of Nations lead directly to France and Britain's excesses vis-a-vis Germany, and that lead directly to World War I? No, what happened actually was the Woodrow Wilson, the Democratic president during World War I, was desperately trying to get the United States into the League of Nations, was absolutely unsuccessful. The Republicans absolutely opposed it, fought it tooth and nail. Woodrow Wilson viewed having the United Nations or the United States join the League of Nations as the his legacy, as the capstone of his political career, and he was unsuccessful in accomplishing it and was bitter about it for the rest of his life. The Republicans continued to control the Congress up until the election of 1932, right after the Republican Great Depression began. And throughout that entire period of time, kept us out of the UN. They kept, or the, what was then the League of Nations. The League of Nations was pretty much disintegrating as World War II took place. You know, began. I don't recall the exact dates of all of these events, but and then out of the ashes of World War II came the United Nations. And in 1945, Harry Truman got us into the United Nations. As I recall, it was Harry Truman who was president at the time. It must have been after Roosevelt died. And although I could be wrong on that, too, it might have been the tail end of Roosevelt's, before he died. But in any case, right around that time, we joined the United Nations, and we've been in the United Nations ever since. And that was essentially the United Nations was started. So in the news, military tribunals, of course. There's really an interesting juxtaposition here. It's an interesting kind of two sides of this. On the one hand, we have this bill that the White House has put forward. You know, military tribunals, of course, are not, you know, like your normal court. Military tribunals are, I mean, you know, evidence in secret. You can't appeal the conviction. The entire trial can be closed to the public. Well, originally, Lindsey Graham, John McCain, John Warner, these are Republican so-called moderates on defense issues. They were saying the Bush White House going too far. And now there's new legislation. Duncan Hunter and Bill Frist are pushing this thing in the Senate. And it looks like everybody else is going to cave in on this, at least all the other Republicans, that would essentially say, yeah, no problem. We can ignore the Geneva Conventions. We can torture people, and therefore our people can be tortured if they're arrested, and we can continue to get lousy intelligence, because that's the thing that we have to remember, I think, more than anything else, is that lousy intelligence is what comes out of torture. We can continue to do that. I mean, this is crazy what's going through the Senate. And thus, of course, why they want to get out. The juxtaposition, worried CIA officers buy legal insurance. I'll tell you about that after the break, and your calls, 866-440-8466, 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Now some they do and some they don't, and some you just can't tell. Some they will and some they won't, and some it's just as well. You can laugh at my behavior, and that'll never bother me. See, the devil is my savior, but I don't pay no heed. And I will go out shining, you shine a light from you. I'll never look behind me, my troubles will be few.
And welcome back, 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman, a radio program for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Although I'm a little unsure about bumper music that says the devil is my savior. Let me officially disavow that bumper music. Yeah, welcome back to our program. Speaking of disavowals, I mean here's your official crazy guy news of the day. I mean, I just don't, you know, it's, yeah, that's it. There you go. Our crazy guy news for the day. The Secretary of the Air Force, Michael Wynn, he says, non-lethal weapons, this is from KARE 11 TV, KARE11.com. He says, non-lethal weapons such as high-power microwave devices should be used on American citizens in crowd control situations before they're used on the battlefield. We wouldn't want to try this stuff out on people shooting at us. Let's try it out on Democrats instead. You know, on people in those free speech zones. After all, that's what they're there for, right? For us to try this stuff out. Domestic use, he says. he says, would make it easier to avoid questions in the international community over any possible safety concerns. He says, if you're not willing to use it here against our fellow citizens, then we should not be willing to use it in a wartime situation. Because if I hit somebody with a non-lethal weapon and they claim that it injured them in a way that was not intended, I think that I would be vilified in the world press. Vilified? I think you're being crazy-fied. I mean, this is mind-boggling. On another subject, Wynn says he expects to pick a new contractor for the next generation of aerial refueling tankers. You know, like, okay, let's go on with the other stuff and just pretend like this guy didn't say something totally nuts! Incredible. Non-lethal weapons, they know, generally can weaken people if they're hit with a beam. Some of the weapons can emit short, intense energy pulses that can also be effective in disabling some electronic devices. So they nuke you, they nuke your BlackBerry, they nuke your cell phone, microwaves, you know, high-frequency sound waves that deafen you, that waves that cause pain. These microwave devices, actually the way they work, is they heat the surface of your skin very, very quickly for a very short period of time. So it's like if you've ever, you know, touched a stove or touched something really hot and pulled your hand away fast enough that it didn't burn you, but you felt the pain, that's what it's like. Getting hit by one of these microwave devices. All of a sudden, it feels like your entire body's on fire. And yet, it's a short enough burst that you're not, you know, you don't end up with second or third degree burns. Of course, we don't know what the long-term results will be. I mean, I remember when I was a kid that you could walk into a shoe store, put your feet in the x-ray machine, and watch your toes wiggle. Marie Curie was handling radium, you know, burned her hands off. I mean, we just don't know. But this guy, the Secretary of the Air Force, says, let's just try it out in America. That sounds like a plan. Yeah. Judy in Dana Point, California, our number 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-8466. Hey, Judy, welcome to the program.
Oh, Michael, thank you for, Tom, for stating that, because that's why I called.
Yeah, Michael Wynn is the guy.
Yeah, Michael Wynn, right. The only thing that really concerns me, because these guys are insane, is people have pacemakers, they have metal hips, they have fillings, you know, all sorts of things that can really kill people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, have you ever accidentally put a piece of metal in a microwave?
Exactly, explodes.
Yeah, I mean, I had one time I put something in, I'm recalling that it was a tea bag with a staple in it or something, the thing was throwing sparks.
Exactly, and I heard this morning on another talk show, and I'm glad you brought it up too, because that's why I called. I am very, very concerned with the mental state of our government, and now I'm getting really concerned about the mental state of our military. I don't want to be afraid. I'm not going to be afraid, but I'm just getting very concerned.
Well, that's why there are people out there. Judy, good point. There are people out there who are afraid. There are people out there who are angry. There are people out there who are depressed. There's this whole spectrum of negative emotions that seem to be focused around the Bush administration and our government. Let's not say our government. Let's say the people in our government, because
exactly.
Our government itself is an institution that stood for 230 years and actually, you know, stands for some very, very positive things and can be functional. It's been demonstrated to be functional. Franklin Roosevelt showed us that it can work, among others. And so but nonetheless, there's a lot of people who are feeling a lot of negative emotions. And my suggestion on this, my take on this, is convert that energy, that negative energy from anger to fear to despair, whatever it may be, convert that into activism. Take that energy and use it to motivate you to get down to your local Democratic, county Democratic Party and say, how can I volunteer, or your local Green Party, or the local Republican Party, and say, you know, I want to be a part of this. We're going to, you know, let's return some sanity to this party, too. I mean, whatever your inclination may be, there's...
No, I was a Republican, but I already went and switched my registration to become a Democrat, and I have gone to some meetings down here.
That's
and,
great.
And I just, it's, I'm... We, you're right, we just have to get involved. We just can't sit on our tuckuses and watch the world go by and say, oh, isn't this terrible? But we really have to get out there and show our support for sanity, logic thinking.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed. Well said. Judy, thanks a lot for the call.
You're welcome.
Good
Bye.
To hear from you. David in Seattle, Washington. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I'm glad you brought this topic up because I heard this yesterday on the news, and my first thought is, wow, another step towards fascism, a fascist-run government.
It's friendly fascism, you know, like the title of the book that came out about a decade ago. It's you know, they're non-lethal devices. These are like rubber bullets. You know, we're not going to do Kent State again. We're just going to make you feel hot.
And so I'm thinking, so who are they going to use this weapon on, and under what circumstances? And it's like, okay, when the masses finally uprise and realize what's going on, then it's going to be, oh, the government's in trouble because everyone's against us now.
Yeah.
That was just my first thought.
Yeah, I share your concerns, and you go over to worldcan'twait.net. I mean, there are people who are saying it's time to take to the streets and protest. Not violently, we're not talking, trashing anything or anybody, but it is time to be visible and to be speaking out and to demand that this regime step down. Frankly, I mean, at this point in time, George W. Bush should be doing what Richard Nixon did. He should do the right thing. He should honorably confess that he has committed high crimes and misdemeanors against the United States and that he's going to leave office. It is time for that. And there's going to be massive nationwide mobilization for this, or we're trying to make it happen for October 5th. WorldCan'tWait.net is the site. And there's other groups working on this as well. And of course, a lot of groups out there, the Center for American Progress and others who are working very hard, Media Matters, MediaMatters.org, Fair.org, a lot of fine groups out there who are working to educate the American people, wake people up to what's going on. And the Democratic Party, too, for that matter, frankly. I mean, there's a battle going on for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party between the right-wing DLC elements and the old-fashioned Democrats, the Howard Dean faction of the party, as it were. But I have a lot of hope for the Democratic Party, and I see it as a good thing. David, thanks for the call.
Thanks.
Good to hear from you. 1-866-440-8466. Ed in Montclair, New Jersey. Hey, Ed, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How's it going?
Good.
Yeah, I heard your report about Secretary Michael Wynn, and I read about that this morning. I actually sent him a note saying that if he thought these were so safe, to try using them on his family first before other people's families.
Yeah.
And
they actually do that kind of thing. It's like cops shoot each other with tasers so that they know what it's like, which is probably a good thing. But the fact of the matter is that a certain percentage of people die from them, and it's just like at what point. I am not so concerned, frankly, with the fact that our government may have non-lethal weapons for crowd control, because there may be times. I mean, I remember the early 70s. There may be times when cities are burning, and it's actually a useful thing to slow things down or to stop people in their tracks if possible without killing them. You know, but what concerns me is the mentality of the people who are promoting these things, and the idea that they should be tested on us, domestically before even being considered for use in the battlefield. I think it would be wonderful to use these things in the battlefield. Can you imagine going into Fallujah, for example? I mean, again, a war that I oppose, an invasion I oppose, and taking the city that I oppose. But nonetheless, we went into Fallujah and we killed a lot of people because the only tool we had was bullets. If we had something that would immobilize people. You know, I think that, it could revolutionize warfare in a positive way to the extent that warfare may be necessary. Again, saying that the Iraq war isn't necessary, but still, that might be a good thing. But to have these people say, no, but let's use it against us first. What?
Yeah, they all have already deployed some of these weapons. During the 2004 Republican convention here in New York City, I went to the protest that took place one of the days of the convention, and it was massive, like 500,000 people there protesting. And at one point, when you got to the head of the protest right near the convention center, Madison Square Garden, I noticed that they had one of those sound weapons right there deployed, ready at the ready.
Well, I remember back in the late 60s and the early 70s, I've been hit with pepper gas and with CN or CS, whatever the nerve agent. This stuff makes you feel really, 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 really bad. Back in my old SDS days, as it were. But Ed, thanks a lot. It's at least it wasn't bullets. 40, but it shouldn't happen at all. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
But if you do right to me, baby, I'll do right to you too. Got to do another. I can have them. Let me have them. Do unto you.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Conservative, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman with you, 1-866-440-8466. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room, by the way. Just click live chat right up there, and it'll get you right in. John in Springfield, Massachusetts. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to know how our government would react if Russia or China did the same things we did, opened up secret prisons in other countries, did a preemptive war against another country and used whatever excuse they wanted or had, or if they opened up bases in other countries. We've got bases all over the world.
Well, the last time I recall a country of any size, you know, say more than 10 million people, launching a preemptive war against another country was when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. And you'll recall the rest of the world did not take that well, and neither did we. So anyway, good point. How would the rest of the world? Yeah, good point. Well said, Tim in St. Augustine, Florida. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
You are live and on the air. I'm fine.
I wanted to ask you a question.
Yeah.
The Democratic Party, the nominee for president, the mm-hmm. last few years. Has been so, I'll say, liberal that the rest of the country can't really relate to him. How?
Well, wait a second here, Tim. In the 2000 election, Al Gore got several million votes more than George W. Bush. And when they finally actually counted the votes in Florida, as the Florida Supreme Court had required, but the U.S. Supreme Court stopped when George Bush sued them, and installed him as president. When they actually counted all the votes in Florida, Al Gore actually won Florida. So you had Gore who won the 2000 election. John Kerry did very well in the 2004 election. How are you saying that the Americans are rejecting these candidates?
Let's just say I am a Democrat, but I feel like the Democratic Party has moved so far to the left that it doesn't even, it's not the party of my grandfather's, let's put it that way.
Well, your grandfather's party, Democratic Party, was Franklin Roosevelt's party, which was pushing for national health care, which was pushing for strong Social Security, which passed the Wagner Act in 1935 so we could have unionization, and the Republicans have been taking apart all of those things. Can you please tell me, Tim, whether you're a Democrat or a Martian, I mean, it doesn't matter, what position, quote, to the left, end quote, that is causing you all this concern that the Democratic Party is taking? One issue.
Against religion.
When has the Democratic Party spoken out against religion?
And it's not so much speaking out, but you can see it.
The Democratic Party has never spoken out against religion, Tim. In fact, if anything, I would say that the Democratic Party is aggressively defending religion. By what the Republican Party is doing is corrupting religion. And James Madison was, you know, very outspoken about this. He did not want the government giving money to churches because then the ministers in the churches would become beholden to government. And that's what Bush did. He gave $1 billion to the churches in the year 2004, just before the election, and an awful lot of it went to African-American churches, for example. And sure enough, he doubled the vote that he got from people who are African-American churchgoers. It went from 5% to 10%. That is the corruption of religion. That is not what Jesus would want. That is not what the Jewish prophets would want. That is not what, you know, that's absolutely inconsistent with religion.
I agree in part, and it's just, I think the Democratic Party needs to do a lot better job at defining what they mean.
Well, I think they're doing a very good job. They're out there saying, we stand for clean environment, for environmental protection, against George Bush, who wants to have more mercury in the water and more mercury in the air, more arsenic in the water. We stand in favor of strong Social Security. Bush wants to dilute it by privatizing accounts. We stand in favor of a national health program of some sort. And Bush is out there going, well, no, it's just fine. There's 50 million Americans who are unemployed. The Democratic Party standing squarely in favor of a higher minimum wage. So that there can be a stronger middle class, Bush being opposed to it, Democratic Party supporting unionization, which helped build the middle class in America, Bush standing opposed to it. Right on down the list, the Democratic Party is quite clear and unambiguous. There are a lot of very strong positions that they're taking that are pro, that are absolutely pro-American, pro-average person. And all the Republican Party has is, number one, let's have a war. Number two, let's beat up on gays and try to terrify people. And number three, let's take a whole bunch of money and borrow it from our children and grandchildren. $9 trillion so far. That's $9 million or $9,000 billion. Let's borrow it from our children and grandchildren and give it to millionaires and billionaires. And this year we're going to pay $340 billion in interest on the money that just the money that Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush have borrowed. And that $340 billion would be enough for 15 million Americans to get full 4-year scholarships. I mean, the Republicans are raping this country.
I agree, but they have to do a better job of, if you put it like you put it, and they meant that and done that.
Yeah, well,
I think they wouldn't be no decision to make. You know, 90% of people would vote Democratic.
Well, see, and you've nailed the issue right on the head there, Tim, because the fact of the matter is what I just said is stuff that literally is being said every day by Democratic politicians. The problem is you're not hearing it on CBS, you're not hearing it on NBC, you're not hearing it on ABC, you're not seeing the corporate acceptable talking heads who show up on the weekend shows. You're not hearing it from them. You're not hearing it on right-wing talk radio. And there's only a few progressive, you know, there's just a couple progressive radio shows out there. So the voices are not being heard. And that's the tragedy in America. Tim, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. And thank you for, you know, being caring enough about America to want to participate in our political process. Coming up next, Jeffrey Feldman with Frame Shop is Open takes apart Bush's physics of safety. That and other framing issues. And we'll be continuing with your calls and talk radio news service and all sorts of cool stuff right after the news at the top of the hour. 57 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program, where reason is our lifestyle choice.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Hey, Andrew, do we have Jeffrey Feldman on the line? I'm not showing him on the board. Okay, the call screen software must have freaked out. So
in studio.
Oh, he's in studio. Pardon the inside baseball conversation there. Jeffrey Feldman is the editor-in-chief of Frame Shop is Open. FrameShopIsOpen.com, the website. Hey, Jeffrey. You should have... I'm sorry. Is Jeffrey here? There he is. Here he is.
I'm right beside you.
There you go. Well, that's what it sounds like, you know. I'm here in Little Beirut, as George Bush Sr. refers to Portland, Oregon. You're there in New York. Hey, it was nice meeting you over the weekend.
Yeah, that was a great event.
Yeah, I did a book signing over at Vox Pop. C-SPAN showed up and videotaped the thing. It will be appearing on Book TV and on C-SPAN sometime in the next couple of weeks. And Jeffrey, you and your wife dropped by, and it was really nice meeting you both. So the website frameshopisopen.com, Jeffrey Feldman, one of the nation's leading experts on frames and framing and all that sort of thing. And the right up at the top of your website today, Frame Shop, the physics of safety.
Yeah, I was watching, like everybody else, the president's peculiar statement to the nation on September 11th, which he interrupted this path to 9/11 mockumentary on ABC.
Or crocumentary.
Crocumentary. And I noticed that he used this really peculiar phrase. It's been repeated a lot, that we are safer, but we are not yet safe. So what I do in the post today is I try to unpack exactly what the bigger logic is that's dictating what the president means when he talks about safety when it comes to terrorism. And I push this idea of a physics of safety in order to talk about the way that the president uses this image of the United States engaged with this enemy abroad in this struggle, this kind of opposing forces, this logic that unless we are constantly pushing against this force that gets bigger and bigger with time, then this enemy, the terrorists in this case, is just going to come pouring in to the United States. And I make the case that it's very much like the way an engineer might talk about floodwaters pouring down into a valley if a dam were to suddenly break. And there's been a large discussion that's going on right now about whether or not we should be using the term war or be talking about police action with regards to what's going on with terrorism. And the case that I'm making is that it's much more fundamental than that, that we are trapped inside this logic of physics when, in fact, we should be talking about something completely different, which is the notion of secure systems. Curiously, when the president talked the other night, he left open entirely the question of securing systems, security programs inside the United States. He made it seem like that all we have to do is engage like some impenetrable wall, this enemy abroad, and everything else will just become rosy and perfect, as if the United States would become this safety zone.
Yeah, it's sort of like if we fight them in Baghdad, and he came right out and said this. He says, you know, the battle, if we don't fight them in Baghdad, they're going to come here. And if we fight them in Baghdad, that will prevent them from hopping on a plane and coming over here and doing something to us, even though our nuclear plants are still unprotected, our chemical plants are still unprotected, our ports are still uninspected, the cargo in our airplanes is uninspected. But Granny's getting frisked, and you can't take a Coke on an airplane.
Exactly. We've got these incredibly ill-thought-out, half-step-behind security measures that are in place that are guarding the system at home. But unfortunately, because the Republicans are using this logic more and more, so they're upping the ante. You know, they're describing the enemy in more and more cataclysmic terms, now using the phrase World War III. They've got people focused on this idea that unless we are locked in against that enemy abroad, then things are going to collapse over here. In fact, I was just taking a look at a book by Bruce Schneer, an expert on security, a book called Beyond Fear, in which he uses the language and terms of securing systems, which is a very, very different way of talking about security. So when you're talking about keeping us safe at home, you need to talk about guarding entrances into the system, talking about borders and ports, as well as entrances within the system into airplanes and so forth. And when you think about this particular logic, it actually provides the reason for why we were attacked on 9/11. It wasn't because we weren't engaging an enemy abroad. It was because attackers got into the airports. They got into the country, and they managed to get onto planes because there were no functioning secure systems and secure programs.
Well, as a matter of fact, back in the 1970s, when Americans were hijacking planes to go to Cuba, you know, you remember that there was this little craze that lasted about 3 years, where people were hijacking planes to go down to Cuba, and the Airline Pilots Association, as I recall, and I may be wrong, but it was one of the groups. I think it was the Airline Pilots, argued that. And in fact, as I recall, there was legislation brought forward requiring this, argued that what we should do is the same thing that Israel has been doing on LL Airlines forever, which is harden the cockpit door. Make it so that that cockpit door cannot be kicked in with anything short of a battering ram, and that it requires a key or a digital, you know, code to get in and out of it, so that the plane can't be seized. And, you know, you may or may not start doing air marshals, but they figured that that's enough to prevent a hijacking. I mean, you can't fly a plane if you can't get into the cockpit. And so the airline industry fought that. They said, you know, well, to do that, you know, a hardened door in a cocpit, that's, you know, that's an extra $40,000-$50,000 expense when you got to take the plane in and retrofit it and take it out of service for a week, and the cost of the door and everything else, and you multiply that times thousands of planes, and we're talking millions of dollars here, and we don't want to have to spend that kind of money. And they got the thing shot down. And so you had these flimsy doors in U.S. airlines, where many of the airlines of the world have not had, you know, they've hardened their doors like LL did way back in the 70s. So, you know, just at the simplest level. But isn't there a larger frame here as well, Jeffrey Feldman, with frameshopisopen.com? Isn't there a larger frame here? And that is that Osama bin Laden, assuming that, you know, the official conspiracy theory is accurate for the moment, we'll just, you know, just operating on that premise, we can challenge that at some other time, that there was this conspiracy by this Saudi Arabian Osama bin Laden and some of his buddies to pull off 9/11, that really that was not so much done because they could get into the cockpit doors. That was done because they objected to our foreign policy. And so shouldn't we have a frame that says, let's fix our foreign policy?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you need to talk about both of those. What's remarkable, however, about this particular week, following all of the controversy around particularly the path to 9/11 and the president's speech, is that the entire question of putting up secure programs to guard the system at home has been completely overlooked. There's absolutely nobody right now, no progressive leaders who are talking about enacting programs at home, just like the one that you mentioned, basic things. They're obsessing over talking about how to deal entirely with Iraq as if that alone is going to produce a system where people feel more safe and secure.
So I have had on this program, you know, Peter DeFazio and Bernie Sanders and others say, you know, we need to be securing, for example, we need to be checking the cargo going into our planes. We need to, at the very least, secure our nuclear power plants. I mean, it's absolutely bizarre that Mohammed Atta, this is in the 9/11 Commission report, that he was originally planning on flying one of those planes into the Indian Point nuclear power plant just north of New York, into the cooling pool, you know, where they've got just a whole great big huge pile of radioactive material, and create essentially a giant dirty bomb that would have rendered radioactive and uninhabitable for 100,000 years an area that included New York City. And he didn't do it at the last minute, and or, you know, within months of the planning, because he assumed that there had to be surface-to-air missiles there that would take the plane out. And there aren't. There aren't even today.
Yeah, not even the most basic system put in place, because there's been so much focus and attention on investing everything in that impenetrable barrier over in Iraq on, you know, on the false premise that that's going to keep us safe at home when it's not.
Right, which is crazy. Absolutely crazy. We're talking with Jeffrey Feldman, the editor-in-chief at frameshopisopen.com, one of the nation's leading experts on framing. And another frame, you see, Bush makes a web page for bin Laden.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that started to happen, everybody noticed this, that leading up to last week, that, you know, the president hadn't really talked about bin Laden in ages, and suddenly, in the couple of weeks leading up to 9/11, a web page on the White House website appeared with all these quotes from bin Laden and Zarqawi and all these other al-Qaeda figures, and the president became almost the personal PR representative for Osama bin Laden. All the resources you needed were right there on the website. It was really remarkable of all the things that the president could talk about at that time, talking about, you know, sympathy for the victims, ways to increase our security at airports and so forth. Nope, all he did was focus on giving Osama bin Laden a clearer voice so that the American people could hear it louder.
Well, I think most experts in this would say that that's what he's been doing from day one. I mean, bin Laden had about 5,000 loyal followers on 9/11. It's up to about 25,000 now, and because Bush made him into an international figure.
Yeah, and in Iraq, the single greatest recruitment poster. But there's been a lot of kind of schizophrenia in the White House as to exactly how to deal with them. And I've been listening to a lot of commentators say that the name of bin Laden vanished over in the interim period and suddenly has been brought back. So it seems that they're going to stake everything on that right now.
Which raises the question, do they have him in a box someplace ready to pull out a week before the elections?
That is the big question, and particularly in this discussion of the secret prisons. It seems that, you know, they were setting themselves up to say, look who else we have hidden here.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Jeffrey Feldman, editor-in-chief. Frame Shop is open. Be sure you get the is open part in there. .com. Jeffrey, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Always great talking with you. It's 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. Viagra for your brain! Just don't let Limbaugh know. He'll want some. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. The Tom Hartman radio program, TomHartman.com, 866-440-8466, our telephone number. Just a heads up, about 30 minutes from now, Greg Palast is going to be with us. The last time Greg and I talked on this program, he was on his way to be interviewed by the Department of Homeland Security, and we're going to find out if if that orange jumpsuit fits real well and when he thinks he might take up residence in Guantanamo. Also, thinkprogress.org is announcing that Air America, which syndicates this program, is going to be declaring bankruptcy on Friday, and I'll, after the next break at the bottom of the hour, let me share my thoughts on that with you and reassure you this program is not going away. Ellen Ratner is with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. And Ellen, over at talkradionews.com, you wrote a brilliant piece, and I understand from talking with Greg Gorman this morning, you got a lot of flack for it.
Oh, which piece?
This was the nature of terrorism and you know how we're doing with this.
Oh, yeah. You mean the one where Bin Laden doesn't matter anymore, supposedly?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's fascinating to watch how politics goes around
the headline for it was Al Qaeda 5 years in counting.
Right. Exactly. I wrote that this Sunday, actually.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you liked the piece. I
thought it was brilliant. I thought it was brilliant. I recommend people go to talkradionews.com and check it out. Forgive me for interrupting you.
Okay. That's fine. Let me just say one thing, which is that if we're talking about the conversation, and that piece relates to it, what Tony Snow did yesterday with the press is the most brilliant thing in the world, and you know what? They took his bait. He got in there, and he went after Kennedy's remarks that essentially said the president was politicizing 9/11, and then he went line by line in the speech, both in the gaggle and in the briefing every day, and the daily briefing yesterday, and the press went and argued with him, which is exactly what Tony Snow wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And
so he got them to play the game on his terms.
Exactly. And he played them like a fiddle. And I was sitting there, and you might say, well, why didn't I say something? Because, you know, I haven't been to a lot of the press briefings because I've been doing other things, and Victoria usually goes for us. So I didn't, because I hadn't, you know, I don't like to ask a question unless I've been to the one before,
mm-hmm.
just so I can make sure I'm, you know, on the right page.
Sure.
And I also was frankly so shocked that the press didn't get what he was doing. It blew my mind.
Do you think that they didn't get it, or do you think that there's a whole lot of people in that room who have positions and jobs and paychecks that they're not willing to lose by having Tony Snow so upset with them that he'll never call on them again?
First of all, Tony Snow does call on people in the briefing pretty much in order. So that I don't think is an issue. In terms of positions, okay, well, let's assume you take the first row, which is, you know, your television, or even the second row, which is television and your major print people. And you go, there's enough independent people there. I mean, you've got everybody from the Russian newspapers to the English newspapers there's enough independent news folks there that somebody could have said something. And nobody did. And it was, and myself included. And frankly, I was shocked.
Yeah.
But I want to get to one other issue, which is next week, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson is going to go to China. And he is now basically saying that the prosperity of the United States and China are tied together in the global economy. This is a speech he gave today. And he's basically saying that we have got to have an integration of China into the global market. And this is just, you know, the Bushies with their China policy. And they accuse the Clintons of stuff.
Yeah, they're sucking up to a dictator who group of dictators who put people in prison for even daring to blog and or speak out in any way and have, you know, run prison labor camps to produce products. But the problem, Ellen, is that they own so much of our debt because, you know, Reagan and Bush together have run up about a $7 trillion debt just between the two of them. The Chinese own so much of our debt that if they just started dumping those treasuries on the world market or refusing to buy new treasuries,
we'd be up a creek without a paddle.
It'd bring us right to our knees. And these guys know it. I mean, you know, Bush has put us in a position where we're laying on our backs with an exposed throat to China right now.
Exactly. And for Paulson to say this, well, you know, a lot of people, by the way, I don't know if I told you that the new transportation secretary was essentially passed over from a person that had been in transportation a very long period of time. And the new transportation secretary, whose name escapes me, is apparently somebody who believes in privatization of roads.
Oh, my.
And yeah. There are some, I mean, that's what they want to do with our roads.
Dwight Eisenhower is rolling over in his grave.
You got to look at this one.
Yeah. Okay, I'll check it out. Ellen Ratner, thanks so much, Ellen.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. TalkRadioNews.com, their website. 27 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to answer, no, not a chance. Be right back.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman. It's just
welcome back to the True People's Radio, a place where smart people get their news. The Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes past the hour. Over at thinkprogress.org, which is the blog that is owned and run by the Center for American Progress, which is one of the best progressive think tanks out there, they have a story. And I'm assuming that if they're running this story, they've got some solid confirmation for it. And I also guarantee you right now, all the right-wing talk show hosts are going to be hyperventilating about this thing. They're going to be bloviating and going on and on ad nauseum. And I just wanted to get out ahead of it as well and tell you what's happening. What little I know about this. First of all, here is what Think Progress says, and I'm quoting from their blog. Air America Radio will announce a major restructuring on Friday, which is expected to include a bankruptcy filing, three independent sources have told Think Progress. So, number one, it's still a rumor. Okay, got that? Number two, Air America could remain on the air under the deal, but significant personnel changes are already in the works. Sources say five Air America employees were laid off yesterday and were told that there would be no severance without capital infusion or bankruptcy. Also, Air America has ended its relationship with host Jerry Springer. They go on to point out, and this is the point that I just made, the right wing is sure to seize on Air America's financial woes as a sign that progressive talk radio is unpopular. In fact, Air America succeeded at creating something that didn't exist, the progressive talk radio format. That format is now established and strong and will continue with or without Air America. Indeed, many of the country's most successful and well-syndicated progressive hosts, Ed Schultz and Stephanie Miller, for instance, aren't even associated with Air America. And then they talk about how Clear Channel is going to partner with the Center for American Progress and Jones Radio and MSS to conduct a nationwide search for the next progressive talk radio star. Well, here's the bottom line. Company number one, we don't know if Air America is going to include bankruptcy in the reorganization. We do know that Air America has been trying to tighten the ship, as they say, for some time. The new CEO, Jim Wiggott, has been brought in, and that's his job, and that's a very, very tough thing to do. In an organization, it's a very tough thing to do. But companies operate in bankruptcy all the time. United Airlines has been operating in bankruptcy for years. American Airlines operated in bankruptcy. Northwest operated in bankruptcy. I mean, it's something sometimes companies have to do. It doesn't mean that they go away. So, number one. Number two, this program, Tom Hartman Radio Program, this program we are now in our fourth year. First year that I was on, this program was on, we were syndicated by IE America Radio, which was a network that was owned by the United Auto Workers. The lineup was Nancy Skinner, Peter Werby, me, and Mike Malloy. And there were a few other people, who were filling that out. The Young Turks were on in the evening. Doug Steffen was on in the morning. And that was really the first progressive talk radio network. It was owned by the UAW. We were on 28 stations around the country and on Sirius Satellite Radio. I'm still on Sirius Satellite Radio as a result of that original affiliation with IE America Radio. The United Auto Workers pulled the plug on IE America Radio when Air America started, and so I went into independent syndication at that point because we have this day part, this noon to three day part, and Air America had already cut a deal with Al Franken. And so we hooked up with Jones, which is the company that syndicates Ed Schultz and Stephanie Jones, and bought satellite time from them, but independently ran the show. I own this program. It's not owned by anybody else. And then last year we made a deal, cut a syndication deal with Air America Radio so that we're on their satellite and the show is being mixed in New York at Air America headquarters. but I still own the program. And assuming that Air America continues to operate, there should be no change from a listener's point of view. And all of the radio stations that carry this kind of programming, progressive talk programming, are not Air America. They are independent radio stations. I mean, you know, they may be owned by Clear Channel, or they may be owned by CBS, or they may be owned by you know, Joe's radio station company, but they're not owned by Air America. Air America doesn't own any radio stations. And so whatever happens with Air America, this format is going to continue, and this show is going to continue. And many of the other shows will continue. Certainly the Jones shows will continue. And frankly, my strong belief is that the rest of the Air America shows are going to continue because they're working. This program, for example, the Tom Hartman radio program in the Winter Arbitron book in the Seattle market, just for example, was the number one show in the market. I beat Rush Limbaugh in the ratings. What's his name? Who's the bloviator on Fox News? It's man, Bill O'Reilly. Yeah, crazy. He is so offensive to me. I have a mental block on his name. Just, you know, beat them all in the ratings. The number one, we were in that book, we were the number one talk show host in the city, period. And I don't mean that like, you know, patting myself on the back or bragging or something. The point is that progressive talk radio works. Progressive talk radio works in many markets across the United States. And in a few markets where it's not working, frankly, I would say that it's not working because it hasn't worked in a few markets because radio stations haven't been well programmed. You know, they're not doing their imaging right, and they're not really promoting the format, or they're putting it on a small station. So I'm frankly very optimistic, and I see this as part of the normal evolutionary process that businesses go through and that industries go through as they change and as they grow. Frankly. And so, in a way, this may actually even be good news for the format, because if this means that Air America is going to tighten up and is going to be able to last much, much longer and do a much more effective job than they have been doing in the past, not to say that they haven't in the past, but even be even more successful, then, you know, have at it. Good to them. But I'll tell you right now, all the right-wing talk show hosts, in all probability, right at this minute, Limbaugh is going, "Sir, I told you so." No, sorry. That's not the case at all. Not the case at all. We're doing fine. Thank you very much. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And let's see here. Scott in San Diego, California on the line. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. As always, it's a pleasure talking with you. Although I have to admit today I'm really frustrated. I'm going to slow down a second and say I typically listen to your show two times a day, first live, and then because I'm on the phone, writing email, et cetera, I pick up the second show on the delay from White Rose and listen to it again because I miss bits.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great show.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sure. Tom, I'm really frustrated because we're very active, a group of us. We meet at Greg's parents' house, Gil and Gladys. We're talking politics, and one of the Democratic precinct captains was there, and I was saying that we have to concern ourselves with stolen votes, that there's no security on the machines, that you can take the memory sticks and do whatever you want with them before you drop them off at the registrar of voters. And Tom, he waved his hand at me and said, "This voting machine stuff is just overblown. We need to focus on walking the streets and knocking on Democrats' doors to get people out." And I'm saying, unless we take care of this voting situation of stolen votes, we can knock on doors all day long. We're still going to lose.
Yeah, but here's the danger, Scott. I mean, you're right and he's right. And here's where he's right. If enough people come to the conclusion that there's no value in knocking on doors because the voting machines are rigged, then they're not going to knock on the doors. And then, you know, people aren't going to show up to vote. And that's a very real problem. I think that what has been happening ever since I wrote one of the very first articles about this back 3.5 years ago, exposing the fact that Chuck Hagel was the president, formerly the president of one of these voting machine companies.
That's not business.
Yeah, and then Alternate, MoveOn.org commissioned me to write a piece that is on Alternate now, and that they mailed out to 1.5 million people about, you know, the voting machines. And this was back in 2003, I think, or 2002, and it was just after the 2002 election, I'm here with you. I mean, you know, I've been talking about this forever. I won a Project Censored Award for my article about the voting machines because it wasn't picked up by the mainstream media, but it was all over the blogosphere and still is. But we have to not allow, you know, this is not a despair situation, Scott. The fact of the matter is that all of the publicity and all of the attention that has been brought to it by people like you and me, and frankly, now it's getting out there. I mean, you know, now you've got even Lou Dobbs talking about it and Keith Olbermann talking about it.
Tom, I called Francine Busby, and she's doing the triple seat stand down. It's like, we're not going to focus on that. We're not going to focus on stolen votes. We're just going to go ahead and go forward, and she'll lose again, Tom.
Well, she may or she may not, but Scott, you got to get it. There's a very real problem here that for the average person who is not the sophisticated political junkie like you are and like I am, I suppose, for the average person, if they get it in their heads that the election is rigged, they don't show up. And we can't afford that to happen. I mean, that's even worse. This is Mark Crispin Miller, who, a dear friend of mine. In fact, he introduced me at the book signing I did over the weekend where the C-SPAN taped and wrote the foreword to my new book, Screwed. Mark wrote, you know, Fooled Again, which is the definitive book on the theft of the 2004 and 2000 elections. And Mark said, and he said it on this program, you know, okay, they stole, you know, 2 million, 3 million votes in 2000, and they stole 4 million in 2002, and they stole 5 million in 2005. They're going to steal 6 million this time. But that means we have to get 7 million votes out. And so we need to be talking about these issues. I agree with you that the guy from the Democratic guy just waving it off was wrong. And it's a shame that the Democratic Party has so often done that, although Howard Dean is the only politician to have actually hacked a voting machine on national TV. You know, he did that on the Topic Gate with Tina Brown program. We play the audio on that from time to time here. And he knows the issue, and John Kerry's familiar with the issue. But we also can't allow people to fall into despair over it. We've got to continue doing our political homework and get so many people out there, Scott, voting, that even if the machines are hacked, and frankly, that's only part of the problem, bigger part of the problem, frankly, what happened in Florida and Ohio, whether or not the machines were rigged, was that people got thrown off the voting rolls. That, you know, they couldn't show up. They couldn't vote. We've got to stand up and speak out about that, but we've got to get people to the polls. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Hello, trouble. Come on in. You talk about heartaches. Where in the world you been? I ain't had the misery since you've been gone. Hello, trouble, trouble, trouble. Welcome home.
Yeah, hello, trouble is that going to be the song that Greg Palast is singing as they haul him off to Guantanamo Bay? Greg?
Hey, Tom.
Hey, you're still free!
Yeah, well, I'm still free because Maxwell Smarts at Homeland Security have had a tough time locating me, and these are the guys supposed to, you know, look for Osama. But
wait a minute, they were having a tough time locating you, and you were like on my radio program last week.
Yeah, I said, well, we do have a website.
Yeah. Well, by the way, we're talking with Greg Palast, gregpalast.com, the website. His newest book, Armed Madhouse, is absolutely a fantastic book, and you got to get it. And all the details, of course, over at gregpalast.com, PALAST.com. But you've been charged with journalism in the first degree, I understand.
Yeah, that's right. No kidding. There is, I'm laughing, but there really is a criminal charge brought against us by the Department of Homeland Security. I mean us, meaning myself, Greg Palast, and my producer, Matt Pascarell. We are filming the last chapter of our madhouse about what's happened with Hurricane Katrina. And, you know, we wanted to praise George Bush because he has 73,000 people living large in these little mobile homes, basically kind of Guantanamo on wheels. 73,000 people in this Guantanamo on wheels. It's aluminum city in the middle of nowhere, Louisiana, except, well, it's kind of somewhere that it is right up near the Exxon Petroleum Refinery. And you've got old people, young people, there's no schools, there's no nothing, there's no opportunities for work, there is nothing. There's one bus that they allow which goes to and from the Walmart, surrounded by barbed wire, and we wanted to film this, which you're not allowed to do, because remember, FEMA is part of Homeland Security, it's part of the War on Terror. And in addition, we wanted to show that it was next to the Exxon refinery where people are sucking soot And they've been stuck there now for a year. This was filmed, remember, just 2 weeks ago. And apparently, the Exxon refinery and the mobile, and, you know, the mobile Guantanamo are critical national security infrastructure.
Whoa. Now, and, I can see these things on Google Earth.
Yeah, that's exactly. In fact, if you go to my site, I don't want to show you the photos, those long-distance photos of the smokestacks, which have gotten us into trouble with America's nouvelle KGB. But if Osama actually wants a map of the place, you can go on Google Map and get very, very detailed photographs of the trailer park and, of course, the refinery, America's second largest and just about the filthiest. You know, what it's really about,
this is really about is PR.
Yeah, it's about controlling the PR. Exxon has previously busted people for taking pictures of their refinery. In one case, it was the environmental division of the Attorney General's office, one of their lawyers on his own, with doing a kind of tour of Cancer Alley of the petrochemical plants that are kind of spreading carcinogens in the rural black areas of Louisiana, and he was busted. But now they've got a new thing. Now it's war on terror. And what they really wanted to do is use, you know, if what you want to do is show a nice clean picture of the refinery for Osama to target, you can get that from Exxon. That's
right.
A video
the PR department will hand it to you.
Right.
This is, you know, Greg Palast, the gregpalast.com, the website, Armed Madhouse, the book, and maybe Guantanamo, the new address.
Now, the Air America wing at Guantanamo.
Yeah, there you go. And who knows? Maybe I'll be joining you there. I don't know. But Greg Palast, God forbid. This is the big concern that so many of us had when the Patriot Act was being passed in the very beginning. I mean, we pointed out that when Hitler passed the Enabling Acts in 1934, right after the Reichstagsgebouw was burned, and the only way he could get those, or maybe it was late 33, the only way he could get those through Parliament at that point in time, the Enabling Acts, which said that he had the right to wiretap people without a warrant, to inspect their mail without a warrant, and to do sneak and peek searches in houses without a warrant.
And you got a problem with that.
If it had to do with terrorism, right.
Yeah.
When the only way that Hitler was able to get the Enabling Acts passed was by putting a four-year sunset provision on them. That if the national emergency ended in 4 years, then these laws would be repealed. And that's how they got the Patriot Act passed. And we were saying, someday they're going to use this stuff against us for things that they just don't like that we're doing. And they were saying, oh, no, this is only going to be Islamo-fascist terrorists.
Yeah,
and the last I looked, Greg, you're not from Saudi Arabia.
Well, I mean, what I don't understand is our president just said that the front lines of the war on terror are in the streets of Baghdad. So how come I'm getting busted in the streets of Baton Rouge? Something's wrong here. And as I point out, you know, if you really want to find out where the refineries are, the trailer park is, you know, just go to Google Map or go to the government's own website. They actually give you the coordinates, the latitude and longitude down to degree seconds where this place is and all the details. So it's not about protecting infrastructure. It is about protecting the news, because very few people in America know that we still have 73,000 people in barbed wire lockdown encampments, which are effectively prisons, except that there's no home furlough because their homes have been washed away. And that's what they don't want you to show, and Exxon doesn't want you to show it. Exxon, by the way, is beginning to get nervous. Thank you for those who put a little heat on. It's had a big effect. And
now, did Exxon make the initial complaint that led to your arrest?
Yeah, as it turns out, we kept pressuring them and saying, you know, is Louisiana still part of the United States and does the First Amendment apply? If it doesn't, you got to tell us who our accuser is. And it did originate with my buddies at my favorite petroleum company.
Amazing. Greg Palast, charged with journalism in the first degree. Read all about it over at gregpalast.com. Greg, thanks for being with us, and keep in touch, eh?
Okay. So, okay. Final of cake. I like chocolate. Bye.
Yeah, okay. All righty. Too good. It's 57 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. After the news, everything you knew is wrong. Is the beast returning? George Bush seems to think so. Maybe Larry Sparks will tell us. 57 minutes past here. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. For your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, it's the Tom Hartman radio program. You know, sometimes you think you know what's going on. Sometimes you think you think that you know what's going on. Sometimes you're not even sure that you know what's going on. Sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you don't know what you know, and sometimes you don't even know what you don't know, and sometimes it's what you don't know that is what you really need to know, and sometimes even everything you know.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. That you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be? Could it be? Is it possible? George W. Bush, today in the Washington Post, George W. Bush said yesterday he senses a third awakening of religious devotion in the United States. This following the first Great Awakening, 1730 to 1760, the second Great Awakening, 1800 to 1830. A big discussion about that. Larry Sparks is with us. He has a new book. It's called The Harlot and the Beast. The website, harlotandthebeast.com. Book is also available on Amazon.com and other sources. Larry, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me on your show.
Sure. Larry, are we in another great awakening, and does this mean that people are just getting more religious, or does this mean that the whore and the beast described in the book of Revelation, the New Testament, are really upon us? In your opinion,
I think it's more upon us than there is a revelation. I think a great awakening. I think that people are moving away from the church and they're moving into their homes.
So you're of the opinion that we actually are living in the last days.
Absolutely. And what gave me my clue was in the 1988-1989, when all of these changes were taking place based on a 40-year cycle. For example, Israel was celebrating its 40th anniversary, the fall of the East Berlin Wall, and that was replaced by the European Common Market. And China's celebrating its, that was when they had the Tiananmen Square massacre. That's when they were coming out of the Mao Zedong era. And that also was the beginning or the end of the 40-year march that we were given the assertive discipline process that was put into our school system. And we were ending our 40th president was going out of office, and we started a whole new, it was all based on 40-year segments, and that, to me, meant the Garden of Eden was reforming.
I'm not quite sure I understand that. Let me just say, you know, for the record, I am not a pre- or post-millennialist. I'm not of the opinion that we're living in the last days, but your voice reflects the thinking of a lot of people in America. And I remember back in the 70s when Hal Lindsey published The Late Great Planet Earth, it got a lot of people flipped out. And in 1980, I remember a lot of people in the church-going folks that I knew who were fundamentalist Christians were very concerned that in the book of Revelation, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but this was the argument that was made at the time, in the book of Revelation, basically in the last days, there's this battle between the harlot, or the whore, however you translate it, and the beast. And the harlot has the number of 666, and or the beast actually has the number of 666, and the harlot has the mark of the beast, the horn of the beast, and we had Ronald Wilson Reagan, six letters in Ronald, six letters in Wilson, six letters in Reagan, that's the number of the beast, and then we had Gorbachev, who was working with him, who has this horn-shaped birthmark on his forehead. And it had people hysterical. But the world didn't end.
Well, that's very true. But a lot of other eschatological things were not present. And one of them, as an example, was the... they didn't have the two horn or the ten horns that they were talking about, which is the going back to your trilateral commission and the other commission that controls the monetary. Well, the euro wasn't even in existence at that time, and the trade barriers had not been dropped. There were several things that just were not in place yet.
But none of this stuff is referred to in the book of Revelation.
Oh, yes, it is. absolutely, and that's the whole point of what really started it was the fact that all of those events that happened around the world after a 40-year period started the clock marching.
We're talking with Larry Sparks. He is the author of The Harlot and the Beast, harlotandthebeast.com, the website. Larry, Ronald Reagan made a comment. I wrote about this in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, made a comment to the Prime Minister of Israel at the time that he believed that we lived in the last days. His Secretary of the Interior, James Watt, was asked once why he was selling off Western lands for pennies on the dollar to big Republican donor corporations and instead of conserving them in the name of America. And he said, well, Jesus is coming and he's going to make all things new. So it doesn't matter if they're, you know, ripped up in mind and things. George W. Bush has not been quite as explicit as Reagan was on the two occasions when Reagan spoke out about this. But the subtext is there pretty clearly. In fact, there are some people who are afraid that George W. Bush is, you know, shares your worldview and thinks that he can speed things up by creating a war in the Middle East that will bring back Jesus. What do you think about all that?
Well, there's those self-fulfilling prophecies. And there's also a guy there in Iran that's doing the same thing. And
yeah, Ahmadinejad. He believes in that in the return of the 12th imam, the hidden imam, or the 13th, whichever it is.
That's right. But it's going to happen without him. It's an interesting process that they really have no control over. They're falling into the plan, if you will, the scheme of things. But they're not going to control when it's going to happen.
But why do we have to? Why does this have to be played out in a physical way at all? What about the interpretation? I mean, I read the Book of Revelation several times actually, and it seemed to me like it was metaphor for the death of ego and the rebirth of. I mean, you know, this could all be the reawakening of us individually in our own lives, in our own hearts, in our own souls, of bringing peace to the world. I mean, in the transition you have to go through to get there. Why? Why do we have to have a scenario where you know millions of people die and horrible things happen? I mean, why can't we view that as metaphor? Why talk about it in a way that actually might, like you said, bring about self-fulfilling prophecies?
In fact, I bring that out in the book through, in fact, chapter 6, which is titled 666, and this evil that's lurking on the earth today. That's not only on a mass scale, which is political and social, but it's also psychological. It's a personal, sociological, and a political process. And it starts at home. You're right about that. I mean, this is something that this salvation, preventing this mass destruction, really starts at home. And what happens here is manifested into our society. Yeah, it can be drawn quicker, or it could be forestalled.
Larry Sparks, the best-selling books in the world right now, second to the Bible and the Koran. But the best-selling, you know, non-revealed religious books are the Left Behind series. They've sold some, 40 million copies now?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, in every language conceivable, they've outsold Harry Potter way, you know. I mean, it's just the only reason that they're not consistently number one on the New York Times bestseller list is because they don't include religious books on that bestseller list. Those books posit a scenario very much like what you're talking about, and there's clearly tens of millions of people around the world who think, hey, there's something to this. Where do you digress from the Left Behind guys?
Well,
one of them is actually an advisor to Bush, I understand.
They're trying to escape. You see, they don't want to...
They want the rapture.
Yeah, they don't want to stand accountable for their behavior.
So they're premillennialists and you're a postmillennialist.
That's what it is. I believe that we all have to stand accountable for our behavior and our actions and what we do to others. And they are trying to escape it. And I don't think that is in the scriptures. I don't think that's the way it reads. I think that it says they're there to repent, and they're trying to get away from it.
So you don't think there's going to be a rapture?
I don't believe that at all.
But what about that's actually Jesus' words, you know, in the Gospels.
Well, he didn't use the word rapture.
No, he doesn't want to use the word rapture. That's what the king coming, you know, a flash across the sky and coming in the heavens.
Well, they talked about the clouds, and that, of course, is another metaphysical a description of something that something ominous, something not quite as it's not like the cloud.
So you're with me on this that's probably metaphor. So why not the Book of Revelation being metaphor?
Well, it is. that man was St. John that wrote that. His life was in jeopardy. In fact, he was.
He was exiled to Patmos.
That's right, and he was the only apostle that did not meet a violent death.
Yeah, interesting. You're right. If history is correct, Larry Sparks. Interesting. thanks for being on the program with us, Larry.
Hey, thanks. You challenged me, Tom.
Good. The book Harlot and the Beast. Harlotandthebeast.com. The website. It's also available at Amazon.com. It's 16 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the True People's Radio.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
All right, welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. I'm going to wrap up that conversation in the last segment. This is a story in the Washington Post today, page section A, page 5. George W. Bush talking with a group of conservative journalists, saying that he sees right now as a confrontation between good and evil. He says the stark change between the culture of the 50s and 60s, the boom, and I think with a change happening here. He says it seems to me there's a third great awakening. Very, very interesting stuff. Larry, we will be getting back to that and to all the other things in the news and to your calls here at the bottom of the hour. Right now, Larry Scott is with us. He is the founder and editor-in-chief at VAWatchdog.org. They are keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to. And, hey, Larry, welcome to the program.
Hello again, Tom.
Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
I am holding in my hands an article from the Chicago Tribune, which I know is referenced at the top of your of VAWatchdog.org, your website, by Andrew Bridges, the Associated Press. The unexplained symptoms that afflict thousands of Persian Gulf War veterans do not constitute a single illness, a federally funded study concludes. Even though U.S. and foreign veterans of the 1991 war report more symptoms of illness than do soldiers who did not serve in the Persian Gulf, there is no such thing as Gulf War syndrome, according to the Veterans Affairs-sponsored report released Tuesday. Larry, what the hell's going on here?
Well, this report was done by the Institute of Medicine, Tom, which is part of the National Academies, or what we call the National Academies of Sciences, and this is their fourth report on the so-called Gulf War syndrome, that cluster of symptoms, fatigue, joint muscle pain, respiratory problems, skin problems, and so forth.
Is this the same group that did the there's no such thing as Agent Orange problem studies back to 15-20?
Well, some of them, yes, as a matter of fact. And what we've got here is scientifically they're absolutely accurate, but they're missing the big picture and they're ignoring a number of things. You can't take all of those symptoms and say this is an illness. Okay, this cluster of symptoms says you have a certain disease or a certain illness that was, or a condition that was triggered by. They're unable to say that, and scientifically, that's accurate. However, it ignores the greater picture. And the greater picture is, you mentioned that, and that is our Gulf War veterans are sicker than veterans who did not serve in that particular arena. They have a higher rate of anxiety disorders, depression, substance abuse, other diseases as well, and an incredibly high rate of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, what we call Lou Gehrig's disease.
A wasting and fatal degenerative neurological disorder.
Something triggers that. We don't know what the environmental factors are that trigger that, but something in Gulf War veterans has triggered Lou Gehrig's disease. They know it's happened. The veterans are being treated by the VA, but they do not know why. So what we've got here is basically the study is kind of a good news and bad news. It's saying from a scientific standpoint there's no such thing as this disease, but the good news is they have admitted that these veterans have more illnesses, they do have more health problems, and this, of course, opens up the door for treatment from the VA. It's kind of many veterans look at this as covering up like the Agent Orange thing or how the government is sweeping depleted uranium under the carpet right now. And what we really need is more. We need good science is what we need. And just this morning, I just received an email from the International Gulf War Council. This is the international organization that represents Gulf War veterans from all the countries who served there in 1991. And they're requesting three things, and that is sampling all veterans, every veteran, and this starts right now, too, because there are problems, for every type of NBC exposure. That's what we call nuclear, biological, and chemical exposure. Veterans and active duty service members should be tested once a year. They're also calling for private research instead of just government research. And they're also calling for MRIs on all veterans and active duty members because they feel too quickly when there's perhaps an emotional or a mental health problem, veterans are sent off to the mental health clinic when there are indications, especially in Gulf War veterans, that some of the mental health issues could be neurological issues. In other words, something happened to the brain that has triggered these problems.
Right. Something physical happened to the physical brain that then produces an emotional
or a
psychological response.
And, you know, there's another interesting thing here, too, and that this study completely overlooks, and we should take this into account, and this is something to chew on and really think about. The rates of this so-called Gulf War syndrome in American and British veterans who served in 1991 is extremely high, virtually non-existent in French veterans. You know the only difference between the French compared to the British and the Americans?
No vaccines?
No experimental vaccines, Tom.
Yep. Yeah,
none.
And we've got the vaccine manufacturers who are a significant lobby in the Republican world.
Right. And all of Big Pharma is. And, yeah, you know, an incredible amount of Big Pharma just supports the...
So part of this might be some just major butt covering on the part of pharma.
You know, it really is. If you really take a look at it, although the VA covers veterans who were exposed to Agent Orange, no one has ever admitted in court that Agent Orange causes cancer and called Dow and Monsanto to task on it.
Right.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yes, sir.
Amazing. That and there's an Agent Orange finding also. I'm just going to have to refer people to your website. It's over at vawatchdog.org. Go check it out. Larry Scott, thanks for being with us, Larry.
Tom, thank you so much.
Great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the pill that will help you escape the matrix.
Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes past the hour.
1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jay in Atlanta on the line. Hey, Jay, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I just came across Naomi Klein's 2004 article from Harper's, Baghdad Year Zero. You recall it?
Yeah, and she did that was a brilliant article, and
really?
Just for our listeners who aren't familiar with it, what Naomi did was a detailed breakdown of what I do in about a 1.5-minute rant. I try to do it at least once a week on this program to bring our listeners up to date, and that is that for 50 or 60 years, the Republicans have been stewing in their juices about the fact that after World War II, Harry Truman helped the Germans and the Japanese, or encouraged the Germans and the Japanese, to write into their constitutions those protections for workers that he couldn't get past the Republican Congress. Things like a national health care system, strong union protections, strong unemployment protections, a strong Social Security system, strong retirement systems, things like that that actually build and maintain a middle class even in times of economic difficulty. And it worked tremendously. It built two of the most powerful industrial economies in the world, and the conservatives ever since then have been going, it's just a coincidence. Germans and Japanese are industrious people. That's just a cultural thing. It's got nothing to do with what, you know, Harry Truman suggests. It's got nothing to do with the fact that they have national health insurance. But they were never able to prove that their conservative vision for the world, or for America rather, worked, because, you know, every place it had ever been tried, it produced a disaster. So they said, hey, if we can take over a country in the Middle East like Iraq, where you have a government that, you know, there's over 100 state-run industries, I mean, it's the perfect place to just flip it. And we will privatize everything. We'll do away with the national health insurance program. We'll do away with the food and housing subsidies. We will do away with the government being the employer of last resort. We'll privatize their Social Security program. We'll privatize their schools. We'll give them a flat tax of 15%. We'll make unions against the law. We'll do all that stuff. And it will produce a utopian paradise. And within 1 year, the economy will be in such great shape that we'll be able to say to the United States, see, the Democrats were wrong back in 1946 and 47, 45, 46, 47, and we were right, and now we've just proved it with Iraq. And that was their plan. That's why George Bush sent his old roommate from Andover Prep School over there to Iraq, and against international law, violating the Hague treaties, the Hague conventions, rewrote the Constitution of Iraq to make all those changes that I just described. And of course, you now know the results. And Naomi Klein lays that out in that argument, in that article, and documents it in such excruciating and undeniably meticulous detail that every American should read it at least once a year. How's that for a rant, Jay?
You put it exactly well, and to build on that, my point is, no, you left out the specific part that McDonald's and Walmart, who might be enticed to come there and invest and build a place, they're going to go, it's illegal, so why would we invest? Because the Iraqis could later appropriate it and we'd be out of luck. So the article just so clearly shows on so many levels the fact that there wasn't even a pretense to try to do this thing correctly. And maybe they honestly think that would have worked. But my point is that everybody needs to read this. And an earlier caller said it's 90% of the people really saw what was going on. And your guest, Ellen, what's her name, said Tony Snow knew how to manipulate the White House press corps. But we need to take back the power of the podium and control the dialogue. And I think folks like you and everybody else on the left who has a podium and the bloggers and such, they need to say for 1 week, let's make this our one focus piece. And so when the CNN lady is going, what are the bloggers talking about today? Oh, again, they're talking about Naomi Klein's piece. Because it's just, like you said, it's just an important piece.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, well said. Jay, thank you very much for the call. And you know, I'm not going to let go of this thing. I mean, I try and remind people of it at least once a week, because I think this is the story that so many Americans need to carry forward to understand that in large part the war in Iraq, there were a whole bunch of different forces that brought that war in Iraq forward. One of them was George Bush's desire for political power, which Cindy Sheehan talked about. And she came, I mean, in her testimony before Congress, she came right out and said it.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend, Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
End quote. And so Bush saw Iraq as an opportunity to build power, because Bush is all about power. Cheney saw Iraq as an opportunity for billions of dollars for Halliburton. His stock options, Cheney has become worth $100 million as a consequence of this thing. His stock options going through the roof. Yeah, he was going to give some of them away. Yes, he has given some of them, but he's still, his salary from Halliburton right now is bigger than his salary as Vice President of the United States. So there were the guys who saw profit there. But the real toxic ones, the ones who really were pushing for this, the Wolfowitz, Feith, Pearl, these guys, the neocon ideologues, the ones that were really the really deadly psychopathology out there, politicopathology out there, are the ones who wanted to take over Iraq so that they could have the tabula rasa, so that they could have, they could say, see, it works. If you simply do this, if you just you do the flat tax, you just do the get rid of unions, you get rid of your national borders, you let, you know, companies employ anybody they want for any price they want, you have the laissez-faire economics. You do it the libertarian way, or you do it the conservative way, or you do it the objective, whatever you want to call it, do it that way and everything will be a paradise. And they really thought that would happen. They were so blindsided by this thing that Don Rumsfeld did not even allow people to plan for the occupation, because they were just going to sit back and say, well, let the market take care of it. And sure enough, it did. Sure enough, it did. Because when you have an absolute free market, the predators come out. And the predators are certainly out, which reminds me, it's a good time to check out what's going on with the occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance.
The following are security and other developments in Iraq, reported by Reuters on Wednesday as of 10:30 GMT. Baghdad, Dateline Baghdad, a car bomb targeting police guards at an electricity substation in the Zuya'ona district of eastern Baghdad killed 8 people and wounded 19. Kirkuk, 4 people, including a child, were wounded when a roadside bomb went off in that city. The target of the explosion was not clear. In Baghdad, a U.S. soldier was killed by a roadside bomb which blasted his vehicle late on Tuesday, the military said in a statement. In El Fatah, an oil installation guard was wounded in a clash with gunmen who tried to blow up an oil pipeline in that city, about 30 miles south of Kirkuk. In Baghdad, a total of 60 unidentified bodies were found with gunshot wounds in the head, and most of them showed signs of torture in various parts of Baghdad over the past 24 hours, according to an Interior Ministry official. In Baghdad, a bomb in a parked car in central Baghdad killed 14 people, including 2 policemen, and wounded 57. It targeted police vehicles near the traffic police headquarters during the morning rush hour, police said. In Baghdad, the Iraqi army killed an insurgent and detained 5 wanted men and 36 others over the last 24 hours across Iraq. 2 bystanders in Baghdad were killed and 2 wounded when gunmen in 4 cars tried and failed to kidnap the owner of a currency exchange shop in the Harithia district of Baghdad. The businessman was not harmed. In Baghdad, police found the body of Safah Ismail Inad, a journalist at Al-Watan newspaper, shot in the head near Sadr City. In Suwayra, police retrieved the bodies of 4 people, including a woman, from the Tigris River. In Baghdad, 4 people were wounded, including a traffic policeman, when 2 mortar rounds landed in central Baghdad near the Muthana military base, according to Interior Ministry sources. In Samawa, 4 people were wounded when 2 mortar rounds landed in 2 different districts in the southern city, about 170 miles south of Baghdad. In Anbar province, a U.S. soldier died on Monday from wounds sustained due to enemy action while operating in that province, a U.S. military spokesman said. And in other developments, the trial of Saddam Hussein and 6 co-accused for the killing of tens of thousands of Iraqi Kurds in 1988 resumes on Wednesday, with more witnesses giving testimony. I don't know if you've read the story. Somebody was giving testimony, and Saddam stood up and said, "I will crush your heads." In fact, many of the people involved in this trial have been murdered by former friends of Saddam. And in Tehran, a red carpet was rolled out for the Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, of Iraq. Yes, literally a red carpet. They rolled a red carpet down the stairs, down the steps, and across the way, a red carpet, so that the Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei, could receive, this is the Supreme Leader of Iran, could receive his new ally, the Prime Minister of Iraq, as he continued today his 2-day visit to Iran. 1-866-440-8466. We'll be coming back to your phone calls after this. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy right here in the United States of America.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
He's a self-made man. He's Joe Republican. Worked hard all his life, built a stack of cash so high. Now he works hard to make sure that you don't get same breaks that he did. Joe's father worked for that UAW, and he got paid well for his overtime, too. But Joe knows those labor laws are old and quaint, relics from that Roosevelt Democrat. And a working man today wouldn't be afraid to put in a 10 or 12-hour day. He's a self-made man. He's Joe Republican.
Yes.
All his life.
Welcome back. 51 minutes past the hour. Yeah, Joe Republican. He goes out and drives on the public highways that are there because some liberal said we ought to have roads for us all, and goes past stops, you know, stops at stop signs because some liberal said, well, let's organize this stuff, and he's got a good public education in the public schools, and because some liberal said we should have public education, and in the morning he brushes his teeth and he knows that the toothpaste is safe and the water is pure because some liberal said we should have pure water laws and pure cosmetic and drug laws. And he has a decent job because some, you know, with a good pay, because some liberal said we should have a 5-day work week and a 40-hour week. And as he's sitting back in the afternoon driving home and listening to Limbaugh going, I just pulled myself up by my own bootstraps. I don't need any of this government stuff. I don't need any help from anybody. I made my own way in this life. All right. 1-866-440-8466. Pat in Gig Harbor, Washington. Hey, Pat, welcome to the program. Pat? No, Pat.
This is in reference to your earlier guest about framing.
Whoop. Okay, go ahead, Pat.
Okay. Last night, well, our primary is the 19th of this month. And I got a call last night. It was a recorded message, and it started off by saying this will take 45 seconds. The first comment was, or question was, do you intend to vote in the Republican primary?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a recorded message. It's so frustrating. You can't even respond to a human.
Right.
But it's an example of how they, you know, this twisty way they have of changing the meanings of things, even and the meanings of words and ideas. And it's just maddening.
Was it, you know, push one for yes, push two for no?
I didn't even wait that long. I was so irritated, I just hung up.
Because I would have been, you know, my curiosity would have gotten me. I would have said, yes, I intend to vote in the Republican primary, and then listen to the message to find out, you know, which Republican is trashy and which other Republican.
Uh-huh.
That's probably what it was one Republican picking on another.
Uh-huh.
But who knows? I mean, maybe it was just, you know, hey, all Republicans, you know, they were going to tell you something bad about Democrats if you said yes.
Yeah.
Or if you said no, maybe they would tell you something bad about Democrats. So if you get another one of those calls, push the button and let me know, would you?
Pardon?
If you get another one of those calls, push the button and let me know.
I will.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Gary? Yeah.
Sorry. I'm sorry. I got myself. Thank you for taking my call. You're still there, right?
I am, yeah. Go ahead, Gary.
I'm sorry. I just have one thing to say, and I like to quote Robert Frost. Thank you very much. We need a new president. We need a vice president. We need strong leadership from new members coming into the Congress. And then maybe we can for our children's sake and their our future, get the children involved, give them some hope, and then maybe we all can see with Robert Frost an America not in the setting sun with a black knight with a spear ahead of us, but an America in the crimson light of a rising sun, fresh from the burning creative hand of God.
Amen. Well said. Gary, thank you very much, and thanks for listening on WPTT there in Pittsburgh. Sharon in Sacramento, listening on KSAC. Hey, Sharon.
Well, I just have a question. I was with some Marines on a camping trip. We're sitting around the campfire. We got some right-wingers there, so we're all trying to be polite.
Mm-hmm.
And then one fella says, well, George Bush Sr. is the one who told George Bush not to attack Iraq.
That's correct. In fact, George Bush Sr. wrote in his, I don't know if it was his autobiography or if it was a book in which he was quoted, but there is, I'm pretty sure it was his autobiography, where he said that the reason why he didn't go into Iraq after the Gulf War in 1991 was because he knew that he would get, that we would get bogged down in an interminable war, and that that's not a part of the world where you want to be an occupying army. I mean, he was pretty explicit about it. And then when Bush Jr. started ginning up the war rhetoric in late 2002, Bush Sr. at first thought that it was just stuff to help the Republicans get elected in November of 2002, which it certainly was. I mean, that was a big piece of it. They were trying to take back the Senate because Jim Jeffords had defected and they'd lost the Senate by one vote. But there, after the election, in December and January, I forget which month it was, after the election, when it became clear that Bush Jr., even though he was sane, that, you know, he wasn't planning. I mean, here's...
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
I'm the person who gets to decide, not you. And even though Bush was saying that, it was obvious that he was heading in that direction. And so Brent Scowcroft, who is a dear friend of Bush Sr. and used to work for him in the White House when he was president, has been a colleague of his and worked with him for the better part of probably 30 or 40 years. Brent Scowcroft published a piece, I don't recall if it was in the New York Times or one of the conservative publications, saying, please don't go into Iraq. And everybody knew this was Daddy talking to his son.
Wow. Well, maybe the son is rebelling against Daddy.
Well, there's a lot of speculation about that. Dr. Justin Frank wrote a book called Bush on the Couch. I think you'd find it very interesting reading. Sharon, I got to run. Thanks for the call.
Bye.
Great to hear from you. Tomorrow, Steve Sinton is going to be on the program in our Taking Our Country Back segment and our Lives in the Balance and Voting Alerts, the best of the rest of the news, that and more, and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman radio program where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least some democracy. And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.